part of their uniform of what actually happened during his detention, I believe. Perhaps you could just update us on that. Any likelihood of getting that anytime soon?
Well, we're looking for the public to support our demand, and there's a public petition to that effect calling on them to release the video footage. If the police have got nothing to hide, there should be no problem in releasing footage of his arrest, his transport to Cardiff Police Station, his detention in Cardiff Police Station, and his subsequent release the following morning. And we're demanding that as a matter of course, and to address the acute and extreme concern of the general public in relation to what happened to him, that those videos should be released immediately. And we're calling on the Independent Office of Police Complaints to do so.
Now, I believe you've been in touch with the family as well. If that's true, perhaps you could tell us how they're coping following the death of Mr. Hassan.
Well, they're deeply traumatised, as anybody was. He was 24, he was expecting his first child. He'd moved recently from London to Cardiff. They've lost a beloved son, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle. So you can only imagine the tragic loss and sense of trauma that the family is going through at the moment. So it's deeply saddening to see them in such pain.
Now, in the little time that we have left, I'll call upon your years of experience. For our international audience, does the British police have a problem with using brute force against minorities?
They certainly do against people, black people, people of African or Caribbean descent. Although we make up only 3% of the population, we make 16% of the total people who are arrested using police force, according to the Home Office data. We're also disproportionately targeted through racial profiling by the police service, who, as an institution, have a culture of institutionalised racism that executes profound injustice on our communities on an almost daily basis.
Well, thank you very much, Lee Jasper, for speaking to us about this story. We will be following it as it develops for sure. Well, we're heading over to the social media world now, and my colleague Ahmed Caballo has been assessing what's been trending online today. Let's bring him in now. Ahmed, what have you got for me?
Yes, I mean, there's been a fierce reaction online. A lot of people are talking about the protest and the fact that 200 people who were outside Cardiff Bay Police Station basically forced this issue and forced the newspapers and the journalists and the media organisations to stand up and pay attention to what looks like another unjustified death in police custody. Now, what's angered so many people, as Lee Jasper's mentioned, is if the police have got nothing to hide, why won't they show the footage? And on social media, we're seeing different people saying different things. And a lot of people are saying that if Black Lives Matter movement was not just a kind of fade in history, something that was a hashtag that happened last year, if it's something sustainable that really shook the conscience of the British public, then they should care what happened to Mr. Hassan, and they should be speaking up about his death. So I've got a tweet from Kasim. He says, if you said Black Lives Matter last year, if you supported the protests, if you learned about white supremacy, if you started a reading group, if you mourn Black Lives more than you mourn statues, now is the time that matters. Now we've got a VT from a friend of Mr. Hassan who was there, who's outraged about yet again the lack of accountability amongst the police officers when someone dies shortly after being in their detention. Let's play that VT.
He was about to become a barber. They don't care about that. They care about the colour of his skin. If I kill a police officer, I get 25 years. They kill us, they get a suspension. We don't need that. No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
So it almost appears as if this is turning into some kind of British version of the George Floyd killing that took place in the US last year.
Yes, I mean, the problem is people look at police brutality, systemic racism, as something that happens over there in the United States far away. But the UK has its own problem of systemic racism, of a lack of accountability. Since 1990, there's been over 1,000 deaths in police custody and not one police officer's been held accountable, even when the evidence has shown that the person didn't offer no threat or did not have a gun, such as the case of Mark Duggan, that started the 2011 riots here in London. Now, Amir has come with a tweet. He says, his family and friends told me he recently got married and his wife was expecting a child. It's absolutely heartbreaking for the family. Hopefully justice will prevail. Justice for Mahmoud. And this is an important point. Sometimes when black people from ethnic minorities, they die in police custody, we think about the way they died and we kind of strip away the life that they had before, the fact that they meant something to their community, to their family, and so on. We've got a human rights lawyer that's asking some pressing questions about the circumstances surrounding his death.
Why was he, upon release from Cardiff Bay Police Station, battered and bruised? And why did he die so soon after being released from Cardiff Bay Police Station? And is there any link to the injuries that he sustained that had any cause to his death?
OK, Ahmed, we just have time for one more tweet and then we'll have to move on. Now, what do you have from the online world?
So a tweet from Neil says, a lot of anger in Cardiff, and rightfully so. A young man is dead and there are serious questions about what happened to him while he was in police custody. We need justice, transparency and accountability, and we need it quickly.
We do have to leave it there for now, but thank you very much for bringing us the additional information on what is turning out to be quite a story of massive public interest here in the UK. Thank you. In other news, British researchers have declared that ethnic minorities should be considered extremely vulnerable to COVID-19. According to their research, systematic racism has meant that people from ethnic backgrounds were twice as likely to die from COVID-19 than the UK's white majority population during the first wave of the pandemic. The report explained that people from ethnic backgrounds are much more likely to work in high-risk jobs, which exposes them to COVID-19. Which in turn leads to the higher rate of infection, hospitalization, and death. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has received the coronavirus vaccine produced by China's Sinovac company in a bid to set an example and encourage others. The move comes after reports suggesting the efficiency of the Chinese vaccine is close to 50%, significantly lower than its Western alternatives. Erdogan called on other political leaders and lawmakers to set an example for the rest of the country. More than 50 million Sinovac doses have been ordered and a Turkish-made vaccine is expected in May. Progressive voices in the US Congress have been widely criticized after refusing to follow strategies to force a vote on Medicare for all during the ongoing pandemic. Robert Inlikesh explains why so much of the US left-wing public are unsure on whether or not to trust the Democratic Party.
The U.S. progressive cry to bring Medicare for All to the U.S. Congress for a vote has been ignored by the Democratic Party's AOC and fellow progressive representatives. Knowing that these same self-described progressives will willingly vote for expanding the U.S. military budget, but never break from their party to grant a substantive policy change in favor of the U.S. public, is it time that we stop viewing these people that say things we agree with or look like us as instant allies? Progressive show host and comedian Jimmy Dore first came up with what became known as the hashtag Force the Vote campaign, in the hopes that the Democrat politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would leverage her vote for Nancy Pelosi to be reelected as Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi is a pro-war, anti-Medicare establishment Democrat who has a large part to play in not fighting to grant U.S. citizens stimulus payment checks at crucial stages of the ongoing pandemic, whilst allowing trillions to go for corporate bailouts. Jimmy Dore proposed that if AOC threatened to withhold her vote in the House for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, if Pelosi would not grant a vote for Medicare for All, then others would follow suit. In fact, it turns out that the vote to elect Nancy Pelosi did turn out extremely close, and just a few votes would have made a difference. However, AOC went back on her past promises to fight for Medicare for All and decided to shield pro-war Pelosi from having to push for a vote on Medicare for All. Instead, AOC and Democratic Party-funded progressive media went on the offensive against Jimmy Dore for suggesting that the self-described progressive use her political leverage in order to get a vote passed on a bill passed in pretty much every other developed country. With the progressive movement now split by this controversy, many taking the side of Jimmy Dore have been left in despair about the lack of real progressives actually fighting for policies to help the U.S. public. Also, the question has been posed as to why the public should value people who talk a good game and claim a certain identity, as this has turned out in almost all cases in U.S. politics to be absolutely meaningless. Ultimately, politicians are supposed to represent the people who vote for them. People should not vote for someone because that person looks the part or is a good actor. It should be on policy. If that politician they voted for then refuses to push for what they received public support to do, they should no longer be in power. Yet, for some reason, people continue to believe in these figures. The same can be said about the right-wingers who support the likes of Donald Trump. Trump was arguing to end the wars and to push a conservative agenda aligned with the values of his supporters. But once in office, the swamp he claimed to be poised to drain became his bath. Whilst U.S. politicians approved billions for the U.S. military to blow up black and brown people all throughout the global South, U.S. so-called progressives continue to obsess themselves with having as many black and brown faces in office in order to do that exact same thing. The reason why it is supposed to be a good thing to have diversity, to have representation of minority communities and radical political thought in government, is so that we can see them represent those views of the communities in question and political movements. If they don't, there may as well all be white men sitting in there in white robes in DC offices, because at least then the enemy is transparent. Progressives have to fight in order to win in government. Just sitting there and getting on camera now and again for attention and to virtue signal, in fact, only works to pacify the left, because they come under the illusion that they actually have real representation.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
The British government has rolled out many different schemes to fight the COVID-19 pandemic's onslaught on its economy. The supposed goal is to avoid mass redundancies and unemployment. But where are the billions of pounds needed to sustain such efforts coming from? The Bank of England is now under scrutiny for printing vast amounts of money, which economists say will further increase inequality in the years to come. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend. The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future, and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down. Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people, and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. So you're looking at something where the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas has accused US President Donald Trump of having trampled democratic rules by denying the outcome of the election and inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol last week. Maas said such incidents should prompt democracies to examine the enemies within and call out political leaders who incite violent rioters to undermine democratic norms. He also highlighted the use of social media to spread lies. Twitter and Facebook both recently made headlines when they removed the outgoing president from their platforms. Well, our final section on today's programme takes us back over to social media, only this time with my colleague Robert Inlakesh. Rob, your first story takes us over to Yemen, I believe. Apologies for that. It appears we're having some audio issues. However, I'm sure Robert Inlakesh will be joining me once again very soon. The topic which we are going to discuss will be the ongoing war on Yemen. Obviously, the United Nations has issued a stark warning to the US following their designation of Yemen's Houthi Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization, which they plan to do this month. The UN has warned that if the US goes ahead with this move, then it could lead to a famine in the region, the likes of which hasn't been seen for over 40 years. I believe I have Robert Inlakesh back on the line. Let's bring him in now for more on this story. So, Rob, I just introduced your story. Perhaps you could give us the details. What's social media saying?
So we're going to go straight over to social media right now and look at what people have been saying online to what you've just outlined there, a horrific circumstance. First of all, we've got from Anthony, who says, all to spite the Biden administration and hand a parting gift to Saudi Arabia, Secretary Pompeo will go down in the history books as one of the most loathsome, villainous, evil people to serve in any capacity at the State Department. I hope you suffer what you prescribed for millions. We've got another one here as well who says, it's absolutely tragic, it's unbelievable that the Trump administration could have this started under Obama. Biden, oh shoot. Yeah, Trump didn't help it. Trump is awful, etc. Lock him up. But this only happened because Obama started supporting it first.
Now, Inlakesh, I have time for just a little bit of analysis from you on this. What do you think is going to happen with Yemen once Biden comes in?
Well, this is an interesting one. Many are speculating that Joe Biden wants to try and get back into the JCPOA and also negotiate to have a settlement, a peace settlement inside of Yemen. If that is going to go ahead, he needs to undo this designation of Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization, also its leaders as well, or else it's virtually impossible for it to get done. And also, if he is going to allow for aid to continue to go to Yemen via U.S. charities, the United Nations, then he has to undo this move. So all eyes on the Biden administration coming into power in just under a week now.
Well, we have to move on to your second story now, but an equally interesting one. It's an area of your specialty, Robert, I believe.
Yes, and interesting developments that we're seeing inside of 48 Palestine, or what some people would call Israel. Netanyahu attempted to go and deliver a speech inside of Nazareth, which is populated primarily by Palestinians, and was met with large protests as he attempted to do this. What was interesting to see is that Palestinian Israeli citizens, members of the Knesset, were dragged off, who were prevented from even going to the protest. They assaulted Palestinians, grabbed Palestinian flags away from them. This is part of an ongoing trend that we're seeing inside of the occupied Palestinian interior, that we are seeing that Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are rising up on a more frequent basis now, are more angry with the Israeli regime for the way it is treating them. We're seeing this in the Nakba. We are seeing this in Haifa right now with daily protests ongoing over the Israeli police shooting of an innocent Palestinian, they say, who did absolutely nothing wrong, drove past police and, of course, did not injure a police officer. And incidents like this where we see even members of the Knesset being attacked as well. Netanyahu was attempting to garner votes, and that doesn't look like it is likely. And it also, as well, goes to show that the Palestinians inside of Israel, of Israeli citizenship, are making a difference in that they are voting for the Arab parties inside of the Knesset, and they pose a problem for Israel even forming any type of government, because Netanyahu and his competitors will never accept to include them inside of a government so they can occupy a lot of space.
Well, we've got a little bit of time for that social media reaction, Rob. Perhaps you could tell us what people are saying online.
The first one we've got here commenting on this says, Israeli police tackles at joint list members of the Knesset and prevented them from attending the anti-Netanyahu protest in Nazareth. We've got another one here as well from a user called Noga, who says, Netanyahu's Nazareth visit, addressing himself to the same public he recently called terrorists and a fifth column. He called on the people there to embark on a new era. He was met with major protests. The police arrested about 10 people, including Knesset members who are immune from arrest.
Well, we are out of time. There is a lot more to say, unfortunately, but thank you, Robert Inlakesh, for your time today. Stay tuned.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be addressing a question which is very important, and that is the following question. Why is it that God is the sole ruler or governor of the affairs of human beings? By governor, we mean the person who has an authority over the lives and wealth of people and influences their affairs by means of commanding them, prohibiting, giving them prohibitions and commands, appointing people over them or removing people from posts over them, limiting their activities or giving them permission to perform other activities, and so on and so forth. Now, why is it that this rule or this governance solely belongs to God? Why is it that God is the Hakim, the sole Hakim and ruler over the affairs of human beings? We can explain this in the following way, and answer this question in the following way. That in reality, this stems from a series of beautiful names and attributes of God Almighty. As we know, God is the sole creator or Khalik of the universe and all beings. From this divine name, two other divine names emanate, and this divine name necessitates two other divine names, and that is that God is the Malik, or owner, of all beings, and he's the Mudabbir, or the regulator of the affairs of the universe. Because he's the Khalik and creator of the universe, he's the owner of the universe, and because he's the Khalik and creator of the universe, he's the Mudabbir, and he's the regulator of the universe. From these two divine names, a third divine name emanates, and that is that God is the Wali, and he has legitimate authority over people because he owns them and he is the regulator of their affairs. Because of this, and from this divine name, another divine name emanates, and that is the divine name Al-Hakim, which we're talking about, the governor and the ruler of the people. So we see that these Asma'ul Husna, these divine names, they emanate from one another in a sequence. And because these divine names solely belong to God Almighty, the last name that emanates from them, which is Al-Hakim, or the ruler, or governor of the affairs of the people, also solely belongs to God. In Surah Shura, verse 9, Allah says, أَمِتَّخَذُوا مِن دُونِهِ أَوْلِيَاءَ فَاللَّهُ هُوَ الْوَلِيُّ. God Almighty is the sole Wali, or he is the sole being who has authority over the affairs of the people. Now, from this divine name, the divine name Al-Hakim emanates. In verse 57 of Surah An'am, God says, "In al-hukmu illa lillah." Governance and rule solely belongs to Allah. Solely belongs to God. Why? يَقُصُّ الْحَقِّ وَهُوَ خَيْرُ الْفَاصِلِينَ. Right, because he speaks the truth, and he is the best of arbitrators. This indicates and points towards another reason or another argument that one might use to prove that authority and rule and governance solely belongs to God. Because God Almighty has perfect knowledge, يَقُصُّ الْحَقِّ, right? He speaks the truth, meaning his knowledge and his words are true and in accordance with reality, they're not false. And at the same time, he's just, and this being just and being the best of arbitrators also emanates from this knowledge and this perfect awareness and consciousness. And because of this, and because of he's the best of arbitrators, and his knowledge is perfect in all respects, the rule and governance belongs to him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at God's governance and rule. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the ocean of dua.
أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. So, brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we talked about another aspect of the state of yearning towards the Almighty Allah. Now, in this program, I'd like to elaborate a bit more on the subject of sincerity in the love of Allah. It is important to note here that the position of sincerity in the love of Allah is higher than that of unity in love. And the reason might be clear to you, because unity in love does not negate any other love apart the love of Allah, and rather it makes the love of Allah dominant over other kinds of love. And subsequently, the love of Allah would be the dominant and reigning love. The Holy Quran says, "But the faithful have a more ardent love for Allah." And this is one of the requisites of faith and a branch among the branches of Tawheed. In contrast, sincerity and ikhlas in love of Allah negates all kinds of love apart from that of Allah. Of course, it is unless they are an extension to the love of Allah and take the form of love for Allah and hatred for Allah. رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. The important point is that sincerity in the love for Allah is not among the requirements of faith and tawheed, but rather it has to do with the truthful ones and their spiritual stations. Allah the Exalted enables His friends and His righteous servants to free their hearts from all kinds of love other than the love of Him. And this is when the station of sincerity is achieved. Imam Sadr alayhi salam says, "The heart is the sanctuary of Allah. Thus, do not settle in the sanctuary of Allah someone other than Allah." And this characteristic is peculiar to the heart. It's just specified for the heart. And the bodily parts move in life in different directions and embark on a variety of affairs which Allah has allowed and permitted. But with regard to the heart, it has been considered as the haramullah. As the tradition suggested, it's the sanctuary of Allah, in which the love of other than Allah and attachment to other than Him ought not to dwell. And that's what actually deserves to be talked about more, because the reference to the heart in this narration as the sanctuary is precise, and it is of significance, because a sanctuary is a guarded area. You can imagine it in your mind. It is closed upon every stranger, and its inhabitants are not harmed, nor they experience any fear. No stranger is allowed to enter, and only the specified ones are allowed in. So the heart is the secured sanctuary of Allah.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad abaz bala bas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
And that's why the verse says that the faithful have more ardent love for Allah, because no love other than the love of Allah can enter into their hearts, can enter into their sanctuary, and no harm or evil can touch it while it is in the heart. And it is exactly due to this very reason that the truthful ones and the people of the Almighty Allah, from the servants of the Almighty Allah, wholly dedicate their love to Allah. And this dedication, this kind of devotion, is such that they never associate His love with any other love, whatever that love may be, unless if it is in the extension to the love of Allah. So they do not let anyone other than Allah enter their hearts until that one or that thing is related to the love of Allah, until the love of that thing or that person is allowed or actually causes the love of Almighty Allah in their hearts. We will continue talking about this topic, dear listeners, in the later programs. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, yeah, Allah.
aperture.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people, because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Now I'm 90 years old.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with the companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह 5.
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की.
The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, Many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is the result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and compose his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, McNicrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return.